Happy New Year, everyone. At the end of the year, we always come across, it's a time of reflection for us all. We look back on the year and the years past, and we look forward to the future and what we hope for and what we expect. Now, if there's one thing from time to time that I wish I could do, I wish I could go back in time and fix things that I've done or I failed to do in my past. And I don't think that's an uncommon wish. There's a lot of stories and movies about it. Back to the Future, Peggy Sue Got Married, the Terminator movies. And people want to go back in time in these fictional accounts for all sorts of reasons. Some people want to go back and just for the money, as an opportunity to make money. Imagine if you could go back in time and put $1,000 in that little upstart company called Microsoft 40 years ago, 30 years ago. Some people want to go back and see a loved one, to fix a broken relationship they didn't fix, to end an argument, to tell someone how much they love them but didn't take the opportunity to do so. Some people want to go back and try and save a life, maybe to keep your friend from getting in the car that crashed that night, maybe to keep them from that first drink or that first cigarette. Sometimes I think I'd like to go back in time and talk to myself as a boy, as a young man. 50-year-old me talking to the 15 or the 20-year-old me. Pay attention in school. Don't worry about getting invited to the cool parties and study hard. That girl will never go out with you no matter how much you ask her out. But this one really likes you. You should ask her out. And don't buy that car. Oh man, not that car. That's going to cost you an arm and a leg. But that's nothing but wishful thinking. We travel through time in one direction only. And that's forward. 361 days of the year have passed. We're on day 362, and we're only looking forward to the rest of it. But all of 2015 is ahead of us. While I can't go back in time, I can try to imagine this. Pretend it's not December 28th, 2014, but December 28th, 2015. I'm going to get to another question. Pretend it's a year from now, just for a brief moment. What if you could step back from a year from now to talk to yourself today? What would you tell yourself? What about 10 years from now? What if it was 2024 and you were stepping back to today to talk to yourself? The great English author Charles Dickens, as you'll recall, he wrote the famous story A Christmas Carol, which has been turned into a lot of movies and plays. And the story will be familiar to many of you. Ebenezer Scrooge is a withered up, miserly old soul, and on Christmas Eve he's visited by the ghost of his former business partner Jacob Marley, who's condemned to walk through eternity bound by the chains of his greed. Marley warns Scrooge that a similar fate awaits him if he doesn't mend his ways. And then there's the familiar story of the ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future, and the effect that that has on Ebenezer Scrooge's life. Now I expect that Dickens, as a man well-versed in literature, was familiar with the story of the rich man and Lazarus set out in Luke chapter 16. Starting at verse 19, there was a rich man who dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered in sores, and the longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked poor Lazarus's sores. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, when he was in torment, he looked up and he saw Father Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. And he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the finger of his water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you had received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been set in place, so that whoever would want to get there from here cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." The rich man answered, "Then I beg you, Father Lazarus, to send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let him listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." Abraham replied, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. If Jacob Marley had known the path he was on, the path he was, where the path he was living was leading, if the rich man in the story had known where his life choices were leading while he was alive, I suspect they both would have changed their ways to avoid the punishments they had earned. If they had stopped to consider that question, what changes would they have made in their lives? So I want to ask you three, I want you to ask yourselves three questions, and it's something I've been thinking about for a while myself. We've talked about a year from now or 10 years from now. Let's project it forward. Where will you be in 100 years? Second, what is the basis of the answer to your first question? Why do you think that's where you'll be in 100 years? And third, based on the answers to those questions, what would the 2114 you tell the 2014 you? I know my answers to those questions, and I expect a lot of people here today can answer those questions more fervently than I can. But I want to look at those three questions a little closely today. And this is just an overview, because these are huge, huge topics. The first option to the question, where will I be in 100 years, is, well, my body will be in the ground and I'll be dead. That's it. When you die, you're just like grass or the animals. Your body decomposes, and that there is no other you besides what you're seeing here. Some people will say that there's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell, it's all just a bunch of hokey. The universe started with a big bang, and all the matter and the energy in the universe, it just is. It expands and contracts, and that's all there is to this universe. That's what's called the materialist view of existence. It's nothing new, and it's been around for thousands of years. So if you're going to go with option one to the question one, question two, why do you believe that's the case? The idea of a godless universe is as old as civilization, and in some ways it's a convenient way to live. You can do what you want, or you can do what you want, or what you can when you can, and you don't answer to anyone. Yes, you answer to society, and there's laws and stuff, but it's basically go out and get what you can while you can. There's a whole lot of seminars, there's debates, there's arguments between all kinds of people on this subject, people who are way more qualified than I am to debate this question, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But I do want you to think about this. Some people who advocate this materialist view of the universe will tell you, like I said, the universe just always has been. All the matter in the universe has started with one compressed lump, and for some reason it exploded and it's expanding now. But for scientific reasons, people think that it will stop expanding and start collapsing and back on itself until it compresses. And this is just a big cycle that goes on and on again. But there's really no evidence beyond that. We know that the universe is expanding, and if it's expanding, it started somewhere. But why it exploded, where it started, it's just a theory. Now, as a matter of life on Earth, some people postulated a long time ago that there's, you know, that somehow there was this goopy soup that got hit by lightning somehow or another and it came to life. And it's a theory, and it was actually a pretty good novel by Mary Shelley called Frankenstein, where lightning hits the reanimated tissue and all of a sudden, you got Mr. Bolthead. Now, some scientists, when really pressed for it, will speculate that life on Earth was the result of an organic crystal that came to Earth on a meteor or a comet or something else that crashed on Earth. It's not a great, it might answer the question of life on Earth, but it just pushes the problem to another level. Where did that living molecule or crystal come from once upon a time? So it's really just putting the problem back to a different layer. Same problem arises if you've got some people who are saying, well, life on Earth was seeded by some super intelligent aliens. Well, where did they come from? You can't just put off the problem. You still have to answer the question, where did life come from? Now, evolutionary theory holds that over the course of billions and billions and billions of years, natural selection preserved the fittest members of each species, who then evolved into more complex organisms, the smartest, amoebas became super amoebas, and those amoebas became something else, and then the really smart ones survived and the really bad ones died off. And if that's the case, then we're really nothing more than highly evolved animals subject to the laws of natural selection, which we're disregarding. If you embrace evolutionary theory, as some people have in the past, then concepts like eugenics make sense. Eugenics is talking about the survival of the fittest. You've got problems, it raises all sorts of ethical problems in society. And we had this problem in Alberta back in the 30s, when there actually were eugenics laws in this province, that people who were mentally disabled were forcibly sterilized by law so that their genes wouldn't be passed on to another generation. It's a dark part of Canadian history. Hitler's decision to rid the world of those he considered inferior, whether it was the Jews, the gypsies, homosexuals, the handicapped, all of those things were his idea of eliminating the weaker parts of the species and propagating the strong. And you can see the problems that's horrific. That's one of the greatest blights of the 20th century. But in a world where might makes right, whoever's got the power can do what they choose on that. And that's not the world that we want to live in. That offends us at a fundamental level. The English writer Thomas Hobbes described this as what he called the state of nature in his work Leviathan, published in 1651. And Hobbes wrote, "In such a condition, this sort of dog-eat-dog world, there's no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor the use of commodities that may be imported by the sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of a man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Now, we live well in our society. We all have clothes on our backs and homes to go to. We sleep on soft mattresses under warm blankets. Our questions every day are what to wear, what to eat, and what to do, not how do I keep warm, or will I eat, or how am I going to stay alive. The veneer of civilization is a thin one. Look to the war zones of the earth. Look to Mogadishu. Look to the Balkans. Look to parts of Africa that are embroiled in war, where people rise to power as warlords and, you know, do what they can. They take the aid that's shipped to them from around the world and they dole it out as they see fit. And that's a pretty grim picture. The part that would bother a lot of people about this is that there really isn't any comeuppance. The bad guys get away with it, doing all the bad stuff, and the good people don't get anything out of it. Most people would say that the bad guys deserve to be punished. It isn't fair that Hitler can just commit suicide and evade justice. If there's someone who should go to hell, according to some way some people think, it's a mass murderer like Hitler. It's someone like Stalin. It's someone like Pol Pot, like Paul Bernardo or Willie Picton, people who have done horrible things to other people. But the world is not made up entirely of materialists. A lot of people all over the world and throughout history embrace a religious view, a belief in a higher power, a supernatural power. Now, religion, as a general term, spans all cultures and all people. The ancient Egyptians worshipped a variety of gods. Did the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Incas, the Mayans, the Vikings, the Aboriginal peoples all over the world, whether in North America or in Australia, in northern Japan. All these people believed in some sort of supernatural being or beings who have intellect and will, beings who have an interest in the comings and goings of mankind and can be pleased or displeased with our conduct. Now, this view, this religious view, advocates the idea that people will continue to exist in some form after death and are either rewarded or punished for their conduct during life. Now, that group suppose, can be divided into two broad groups. Those who believe in an intelligent superbeing, and those who believe that upon achieving enlightenment, the spirit is released into a great pool of similarly released enlightened spirits, like a glass being poured into an ocean. This is a sort of middling view of life, of a sort of a life force, the view that God is not so much a being of intellect, but is just a force inhabiting all things. God is in rocks and in trees and in the pulpits, and he's in my little bottle of water here and in this hat that somebody apparently left on the pulpit. If you ever saw the Star Wars movies, it's that sort of concept. The force is in all things. But the problem with that perspective is that it confuses the artist with the art. You might say, I put a lot of myself into a piece of furniture I make. But that just means I spent a lot of time crafting the piece, that I spent a lot of time designing it and selecting the materials and crafting the wood and then finishing it. Now, you'll certainly find some of my sweat, and you'll probably find some of my blood in there too, you know, sharp tools and all. But that just means the work reflects me, but it's not me itself. A third option, after materialism, in the second view, it's called pantheism as a formal term, is what's called a religious worldview. That's the concept that there's a happy place and a bad place. And that worldview is as old as mankind too. All the ancient cultures they're referred to, the Egyptians, the Incas, the Mayas, the Vikings, the Chinese, they all buried their dead surrounded by stuff to take into this afterlife because they thought they would need it. The big question among all these cultures has always been how to get into the happy place and avoid the bad place. Now, there's two schools of thought on this. One school of thought is essentially what's called a balance theory. All the things that you do in life have some sort of spiritual mass, either good or bad. And you put all that good stuff on a pan on the scale and all the bad stuff on the other pan and hope that the good stuff outweighs the bad stuff. And if it's a bit close, maybe the big guy will cut you some slack and let you in anyways to the happy place. It's a bit crude, but that basically describes the concepts of kismet, of karma, of reincarnation, enlightenment, paradise, and the other world religious views. The question is, why do you believe this to be the case? Why do people believe this to be the case? Now, I remember when I was just a little boy, first or second grade, long time ago, I had to write a little report in first or second grade about Africa and what things were like in Africa. And I remember, because that's what we were studying in that little part of the school class, and I remember in my little, you know, one sheet piece of paper, I wrote that elephants were yellow. And my teacher asked me about it. She said, George, why do you think elephants are yellow? What makes you say that? And I said, well, here's my little Curious George book, and there's Curious George at the circus next to a yellow elephant. It was the only elephant I had ever seen. Why would I think an elephant is anything but yellow if that's the only thing I'd ever seen in my life? I know better now. They come in different colors. Now, there are two things we can know about in life. We can know about ourselves, and we know about ourselves. I know what it means to be a human being, to be a man. I don't know what it means to be a fish. I don't know what it means to be a bird or to be a cabbage, but I do know what it means to be a human being. I have inside information about being human because I am one. Now, one of the peculiar things about being human is having a conscience, what the author C.S. Lewis described as the moral law. We live under something that we intrinsically feel, recognize as the moral law. It's not something that we see from the outside, but we see it from the inside. From a materialist view, it makes no sense. Now, evolutionary theory, going back to that concept, holds that humans evolved from a lower species of series of prehumans, Neanderthals, Piltdown Man, and down and on and on, down an evolutionary tree. Now, I think most evolutionists agree that during some time, you know, according to the evolutionary theory of the world, that once upon a time, mankind, humans, pre-humans, sort of sprung up in the sort of Middle Eastern, sort of Mesopotamian area when Earth was one big continent called, I think it's Pangaea or something like that. And then something happened where the Earth broke up and different people on different continents drifted apart. And then there was no contact among these peoples for centuries, if not millennia. And so you had people developing North America and the, you know, the Aboriginal cultures here, you know, the South American culture and Australian and so on and so on. But you look at all those cultures separated according to their theory, you'll find stunningly similar concepts of right and wrong across all cultures and all societies. No culture has ever valued cowardice over bravery. No culture has ever valued deceit over honesty. Humans, on a broad scale, value the same things, regardless of culture and time. Now, some may argue that our consciences or this desire to follow this moral law are merely social conventions taught to us as children, which we have a hard time shaking loose. Just because we learned it from our parents and teachers doesn't mean it's a social convention. There are different things happening, that there are different things that we learn as we grow up. We learn some things that are simply the universe as it exists. We learn, for example, about science. Science tells you how things are, that if you take two molecules of hydrogen and put it together a molecule of oxygen, you have water. That is simply how it is. H2O is water. You learn, for example, that 5 times 5 is 25. It's a mathematical law. You learn about things like the Pythagorean theorem, the idea that triangles and the hypotenuse and the ratios they bear. You learn about things like pi, the relationship of the radius of a circle to its circumference and its area. Those are simply descriptive laws of the universe. Now, some things are conventions that we learn. We learn to drive on the right-hand side of the road, whereas in England, they learn to drive on the left. That's just a matter of choice. 40 years ago, we were wearing, probably people wouldn't have been in here, in bell-bottom jeans and tie-dyed shirts. We don't do that anymore. In the 80s, it would have been mullets and skinny ties. That's just a matter of convention. Who knows what the style and fashion will be in a few years. Social conventions can vary across space and time. But the moral law, on the other hand, isn't merely a social convention. It's similar in concept, more like the law of gravity in that it describes the universe we live in, and not something that we just decide how to be. Without the moral law, comparing cultures and actions across societies would be pointless. Laws of a country do not create moral law, but are held up against it. Could we say, for example, if you take the concept of, well, if the law says it's right, then it is right. All you have to do is look at the laws of Nazi Germany to see what their laws were like. Where it was a criminal offense to be a Jew, it was a criminal offense to hide a Jew, and that the extermination of the Jews and the other targeted peoples were according to Nazi law. But the law itself can't make right or wrong. And it's pointless to talk about right and wrong if you're comparing cultures without reference to a moral law. You have to have some third thing to compare the two things to. You look at the sanctions that the UN talks about. We talk about different lifestyles, different choices that people, different laws in different countries, where you've got some parts of the world where it's illegal to educate young girls. And we say that's the wrong, and we say that's a bad law. Well, how can we say it's bad unless we're pointing to something else outside as a comparator? And once we have a moral law, once we have that third thing, that doesn't come from Canadian society, doesn't come from American society, doesn't come from German or Islamic society or any of those other societies, we have to figure out where it comes from. What's the source of that moral law? Now, the religious view accepts that the source of law is some being, some person, that prefers certain conduct over other conduct. Conduct that guides us by that moral law. That being prefers honesty to dishonesty, courage over cowardice, forthrightness over subterfuge, freedom over slavery, and order over chaos. The religious view goes on to hold that we are accountable for our actions as measured as against the moral law. Now, some religions will advocate a cycle of rebirth or reincarnation on the idea that the more good you do, the better your next life will be, whereas if you're bad, you'll come back as a slug or a flea. Now, some religions, including Christianity, assert that after death, there comes judgment. Most religions who make this assertion, and frankly, most people who believe this view without actively subscribing to any particular religion, assert that judgment is based upon our conduct on earth. All the good stuff goes into one pan on the scale, and all the bad stuff goes into the other pan. But that can become a very complicated exercise in determining good and bad. Now let's take an example. Mrs. Yubuchi, I'm going to use you as my example. It's okay, nothing bad will happen to you. Now suppose I'm walking along and I see Mrs. Yubuchi standing there and I knock her to the ground. I hip check her right into the pews. Did I do a good thing or a bad thing? Probably pretty bad, right? Now suppose I trip on the carpeting and I hit Mrs. Yubuchi as I'm falling. Am I still morally blameworthy? Now suppose I try to hip check Mrs. Yubuchi into the pew, but I miss. I don't actually make contact. Did I do a good thing or a bad thing? Is it less bad or less good? Suppose I try to knock Mrs. Yubuchi to the ground and I miss and I hit Mr. Roberts instead. Okay, now where's my moral blameworthiness? How many demerit points do I get for that? Now suppose I knock Mrs. Yubuchi to the ground and I do so deliberately, but it's because Jeff is swinging a baseball bat at her and I'm pushing her out of the way. Okay, did I do a good thing or a bad thing? Now suppose, take another example. Suppose I shoot someone deliberately. Good thing or a bad thing? But suppose I'm a soldier in the middle of a battle. Am I protecting my country or invading one? Am I a German soldier invading Poland or Czechoslovakia? Or am I a German soldier falling back in the face of a British advance on Germany? Am I a British soldier advancing? I mean, whole questions of moral blameworthiness and how much guilt. I mean, sometimes we have a lot of problems figuring out what's good and what's bad, much less trying to assign a weight to it. As many of you know, I'm a football fan, so I have to work a football reference into every sermon. And if you followed the NFL this season, you've seen that they've had all kinds of problems with this too. There have been a couple of players that have gotten themselves into trouble with the law. Ray Rice, the running back for the Baltimore, formerly is the key. He's not a running back. He's not in the NFL anymore. He got in trouble because he and his wife got into an argument in Las Vegas, and there's video footage, and he punches her in the head and knocks her cold in the elevator. And the original footage was just him dragging her out of the elevator over his shoulder. Later on, the in-elevator footage was revealed. And the NFL first gave him a 2-game suspension for that, and people lost their minds. They said, what? 2-game suspension for knocking somebody's wife, for knocking your then-fiancé, now-wife, out cold? That's heinous. Now, some of the guys that really had a problem with that were the guys that got 6-game suspensions for having tested positive for having marijuana in their bloodstream because they'd smoked pot. The NFL said, if you smoke pot, that's a 6-game suspension, but if you knock your wife cold, that's only a 2-game suspension. Something wrong there. So the NFL switched gears and said, okay, lifetime ban, after he'd already served the 2-game ban. So that's resulted in all sorts of legal wranglings and back and forth and so on and so on. But the problem is, how do they sort this out? And how do you sort it out on a life scale? How do you judge a man's life to determine the fate of his soul? There have been some news reports I was reading about a little while ago about former concentration camp guards, now very, very old men, who are charged, being charged and tried for crimes against humanity. A fellow named Johann Breyer was arrested in Philadelphia just this past summer for having been a guard at Auschwitz and Buchenwald, and he's charged with 158 counts of aiding and abetting Nazi atrocities during the war. This fellow emigrated to America in 1952, got married, raised a family, lived his life, and then he gets arrested in 2014 for events that happened 80 years ago. Suppose he did aid and abet the Nazi atrocities during the war. Could he ever make up for that on a cosmic balance? Are there crimes so heinous that they can never be atoned for? Suppose Mr. Breyer had moved to India after the war and worked tirelessly alongside Mother Teresa for the rest of his life, helping orphans and lepers all his days. Would 60 years of selflessness and charity outweigh 6 years of evil or even condoning evil? This concept of cosmic balancing is a tough one. How would you ever know where you stood on the scale? Do you know if you have a positive balance in your soul account, or are you overdrawn? Moreover, where do you get the idea that the final tally is even a balance? What if it's more like a school test? You need 60% to pass, or 70%, maybe 80%. 2 weeks ago at work, I had to do a little online test as part of my sort of continuing education program at work. And it told me right at the outset, it said, pay attention, there's 2 hours of instruction, and there's going to be a test at the end, and you need 70% to pass this thing, or you got to do it all over again. Now, it would have done me no good to say, look, I got 65%. That's pretty close, right? And number 5 was tricky. You know, that was, you know, could have gone either way. I didn't get it completely wrong. I got it kind of wrong. Can you give me a mulligan on it? Can you give me a pass? But the Bible tells a different story. The Bible tells us, yes, there is a God, and his name is I Am. He's a spirit, he's eternal with no beginning and an end, and he created us and everything around us through an act of his will. He's the source of that moral law. He built it into each one of us. But at the same time, he also gave us free will. We can choose to obey him and the moral law or not to. Millennia ago, our earliest parents, two people named Adam and Eve who had walked and talked with God, were charged with tending a garden as their job, they chose to disobey God. God had created the universe, and he planted a garden in a place called Eden. He told his children they were free to eat of every fruit and plant except one. Everything else except that one. You're all like me. What's the one thing, if somebody says don't do this, one thing, what's the one thing you're going to be drawn to? If I say you can think about anything you want except a yellow elephant. What's running through your mind right now? It's a yellow elephant. The Bible goes on to tell us that an enemy of God, this supernatural creature created by God to serve as his highest servant, an archangel, rebelled against God and became God's enemy. Satan, this enemy, approached Eve and asked her about the fruit. Did God really say, you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, we may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden. You must not touch it or you will die. And here comes the great lies. You will not certainly die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it too. Now that disobedient nature has been passed down to us over the generations. It's like a spiritual genetic flaw that all of us are infected with. Satan told two great lies to Adam and Eve that day. He said mankind wouldn't die if he disobeyed God. He completely contradicted God and told an outright bald-faced lie. You certainly will not die. Yes, you will die. 2, Satan told man that he would become like God. Now, Christians accept the Bible as God's instruction manual for life. There's a rather terrible movie that I don't recommend to anyone. And one character described the Bible, he came up with an acronym for Bible, B-I-B-L-E, Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth. That was the only good thing in the whole two-hour movie. And it kind of stuck with me. Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth. The religions of the world will have you believe that there are many roads to God, that if your good outweighs your bad, you may get to go to heaven. But that's just mankind taking on the role of God, setting the rules for the final test. And that's not our place. There is a judgment after death, but we only get one shot at life. There's no mulligans. And the standard is not a balance. It's not a ledger sheet, and it's not a school test. The standard is perfection, 100%. All of humanity, the whole of creation, was cursed because two people ate a piece of fruit that they were told not to eat. That single act condemned all of mankind from then on to death and destruction. That's it. It's that one thing. It wasn't, they didn't go out and, you know, march and invade, you know, nations or start a genocide or any, you know, the big heinous things. They disobeyed God. He said, don't eat that piece of fruit, and they ate it. So all that, the whole balancing theory, they may have done a whole bunch of good things. They, Adam and Eve, may have been great gardeners. They may have tended that garden and done a great job. There's no balance. The standard is perfection. In order to get into heaven, you have to meet that standard. And if you don't meet it, that's it. Game over. And the only other place that God created for our soul, for souls to be after death, there's heaven and there's hell. And that's it. We believe that because the Bible tells us this is the case, we believe the Bible is a reliable source of information. Now, frankly, I'd be a little bit more concerned if Christianity was the other way around. If all the world's religions said, you've got to be 90% perfect to get into heaven, and Christianity came along and said, no, it's actually 50-50. We're going to give you the easier way into heaven. It's the other way around. Christianity and God's message to people is, there's only one way to get to heaven. And that's the sobering reality of life. But there's good news. That's what gospel means. Gospel means good news. Despite the fact that the standard is perfection, and despite the fact that no one can meet that standard, and don't kid yourselves, if anybody thinks they're perfect, just live for one day and you'll find out, live one day honestly, and you'll see how imperfect you are. I do it every day. I look at myself and it's like, man, I can't go like an hour without messing something up. Except maybe when I'm sleeping. That's about the only time I'm kind of safe. We celebrated this week the birth of God's way, Jesus Christ. Jesus' name means God shall save his people. That's exactly what Jesus means. That baby, the child of a mortal woman named Mary, and quickened by God himself, there's no mortal father, he grew into a man. He lived his entire life in perfect conformity with God's law, with the moral law, and never failed once. Despite his perfect life, while he was condemned by men and nailed to a cross, and while he hung on that cross, God punished him for all our infractions of the moral law, for all our disobedience to God. And Jesus wasn't just some poor guy picked out of a crowd who got got nailed to a cross. He was the Son of God who came to pay that price, to take that punishment. His whole purpose was to be lifted up on that cross and to take the punishment that humanity deserved. And that punishment is so terrible, it's so horrible, it's so eternal, that God, in his great love for us, sent his Son to die so that no one had to go to hell. It's not a kind of place where it's like, oh, it's kind of like being in Winnipeg in January. You know, it's kind of like dismal and bleak, but, you know, you can learn to get, it's horrible. God took on human form, lived 33 years as a man, taught, preached, and then allowed himself to be nailed to a cross to die the most horrible death ever invented, and then faced all of God's wrath hanging on that cross just to avoid us having to go there. That's how horrible a place it is. And when Jesus finished paying that price in full, he said, "It is finished," and he gave up his spirit. Now, how Jesus paid that price, how his time on the cross paid for the sins of humanity, I don't know the mechanics. It's like that hymn that we sang. I don't know the absolute fundamental spiritual nitty-gritty mechanics of it all. But I don't know how the mechanics of how a million-pound plane gets to take off in the air and fly all over the world. I was doing some reading on this earlier, and I was there's a book called Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe, B-E-H-E. And he's a biochemist, and he talks about some of the things that we just take for granted. And one of them came to my mind last night as I was watching a bit of TV. My cat jumped up and scratched me on the nose and started to bleed a little bit. And this little thing from Michael Behe's book came back, where he described the chain of events that happens in blood clotting, the biochemical process of blood clotting. And it's this huge, it's like, wow, if you see like super math equations, this puts them to shame, because it's this whole biochemical, this happens to that. And I don't know any of that. I haven't got a clue what any of that means, but my nose isn't bleeding, and I know it's not bleeding. I don't understand it, but it works. And this is what Christians believe. That Jesus, after having died, given up his spirit, lay in a tomb for 3 days. He was dead, dead as a doornail. He didn't swoon, he didn't pass out. His followers didn't take him off the cross and nurse him back to health. He was dead. And then he was raised to life 3 days later, and he was seen by hundreds of witnesses, including his followers. And this is what Christians believe, because he told us this. That God, the creator of humanity and the author of the moral law, loves his creation so much that he sent his one and his only Son, Jesus Christ, to be our Savior. Whoever believes on him, that is on Jesus as the Savior of humanity, who as the one who paid the price for our disobedience to God by giving his life as a ransom for ours, anyone who believes on that is saved. And that's what Christians believe. Christianity teaches an exclusive way to God. Christianity does not accept any other path to God, because we believe God when Jesus told his disciples, "I am the way, the truth, and life. No one gets to God except through me." There's no asterisk, there's no little footnote after that that says, or, you know, Allah or Buddha or, you know, transcendental meditation or Moonism or whatever. One way. Now, at the beginning of my message this morning, I'd asked you to do a couple of things. First, I'd asked you to consider where you're going to be in 100 years. Second, I asked you to consider why you believe that. On what basis do you believe the answer to your first question is correct? Finally, given those two questions that you put to yourself, if you could travel back from 100 years in the future, if the 2114 you could travel back to today, what would you tell yourself today? What would you tell yourself? Would you tell yourself to change anything? Are you content with how things are? Spend some time on these questions. These are important questions. These are the big ones. Why do you believe what you believe, and how sure are you of the correctness of your answer? What can you do about it today? No one can beat you into being a Christian. No one is going to hold a gun to your head and say, "Repent or die." God gave us all free will to reject him or to accept him. That's a choice he made. But don't reject him out of ignorance or half-baked ideas. Investigate God. Even if you don't believe he's real, even if you're at a place where you say, "No, this is all just a bunch of religious hokey," investigate, learn, spend some time thinking about these questions. Ask him to reveal himself, because God has promised, "Whoever seeks me will find me." You won't get some big flash of light. There won't be any big burning bush in the desert or anything like that. But he has promised, "Whoever looks for him will find him." And whether it's, you know, coming here to Bethel, studying the Bible with the rest of us in little bite-sized pieces, doing some reading on your own. Have a look at, if you're interested in following this, C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, wonderful book. C.S. Lewis was an atheist, and he was a brilliant author, and he came to know the Lord through, he was, an Anglican, remember the Anglican Church, but that's where he got to. But he got there through study and analysis and thinking about these questions, and a lot of the stuff I talked about today is drawn on his book. You can look to some of Lee Strobel's work, The Case for Christ, The Case for Christmas, The Case for Faith, The Case for Easter. He's another fellow that started off as an atheist and said, okay, I've heard a lot of this stuff about Christianity, I'm going to do some investigating. And he used his skills as, he was trained as a lawyer, he was also a reporter in Chicago, and he used those skills to start to actually investigate, as if it were a case or a modern story. And his investigation led him to salvation. So that's my challenge to you. On the one hand, if you're not there yet, spend some time thinking about this. This is a huge question. This is the life question. And if you're there already, if you can say, I know where I'm going to be in 100 years, in 100 years I'm going to be with the Lord. Spend some time preparing for that, getting to know Him better through His Word, through prayer, through meditation with Him, spending some time getting to know the place where you're going to be. It's almost as if you're going on a trip. If I was going to be going somewhere else, I'd spend some time reading up about it, trying to figure it out. Who am I going to be spending time with? What's Australia like if I'm going to go to Australia? What are the customs like? What are the people like? And that's right here. Oh, sorry. I almost grabbed my clipboard. Right here, Bible. Basic instructions before leaving Earth. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, gracious Father, for the gifts you have given us, for the blessings of the past years and the hope for the coming year. Thank you for giving us a reason to hope, a reason to look forward to the future, and a future with you. Thank you for the Bible, your guidebook to tell us who you are, where we came from, why we're here, how to behave while we're here, and how to prepare for when we're, for where you want us to be with you. Thank you most of all for the gift of your Son, Jesus, through whom and by whom this is possible, for sinful people like us to become your people, forgiven and blessed. Father, for those who have not yet come to know you, reveal yourself to them, Father, that they may not come to know you as the loving Father you are. For those who know you as Father, Father, who know you as Father, please strengthen our faith, strengthen our hearts, and help us to get to know you better.